Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening, wear sunscreen. Do people still know Baz Luhrmann? Is that a thing? Look up the sunscreen song, whatever it's called.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of Slaughter. My name is Lucy and I am joined by Emma, outstanding teacher, not award-winning podcaster, someone creative.
Nominated podcaster.
Nominated.
We could have a whole award ceremony where we're the only nominees. Like, oh, best host of Slaughter called Emma. I think I've won it.
Best teacher who does a podcast.
Yeah.
Lucy.
Best British accent in this episode.
Yeah. I'm going to be telling you the story of Ursula and Sabina Eriksson, which I've been meaning to do for quite a long time because, do you remember before on-demand TV when you would watch TV?
When I would watch Judge Judy on YouTube.
Before that. Before, say when you could you'd watch so much TV that you'd end up rewatching the same shows.
When I used to have a complete tantrum if I missed the program I wanted to watch, because that was it. But I have to watch 5 hours of Friends a day.
But I remember watching this episode of Motorway Cops multiple times, and I would never sit down now and watch Motorway Cops. I was just watching what was on. There were four channels, and I feel like I pretty much covered everything.
It was like an advert flicker.
Yeah. On this episode of Motorway Cops, I remember these two girls running onto the motorway, and this is what sort of sparked my interest in this case, but I had no idea that it was such a big sort of crime story. Do you know what I'm talking about? Can you visualise sort of the clip?
I do. I remember watching this clip where the girls just run out into traffic, and it's quite disturbing.
It's so weird.
Like, more so than when we talk about other things, when you watch the clip, like, it's quite frightening in a weird way, because you just, it makes no sense.
Yeah, it makes zero sense. So by the end of this, it will still make no fucking sense, but we'll do our best. So this is Ursula and Sabina, and they were born in Sunne, S-U-N-N-E, which is a small town in Sweden, in 1967. And they lived with their mother and their older sister. And I think they had a brother as well, who's sometimes mentioned. But a lot of this information sort of... I found conflicting information about this whole case, because they're not really public about things. There's not been a lot of interview... Well, there's been no interviews. But also... it's one that people theorise about, but that maybe there's a lot of stuff that sort of I went to school with them and I can remember this, which isn't really substantiated evidence. So it's hard to know. I mean, I couldn't even get a clear answer as whether they were identical twins or not to that extent. But some of this comes from A Madness Shared by Two by David Kahn, which is a book that was been written by someone who looks in a lot of detail at a lot of the theories. But I also watched the BBC documentary about this. If you just go on YouTube, it's on there. And then I looked at some articles. So there's quite a few different sources that I used for this.
I feel like the lady doth protest too much.
I did research, I promise.
And then I went to visit their hometown in Sweden, but I couldn't get you a souvenir, so I just came straight back.
So their father had one arm. He lost the one that he lost in the Finnish Winter War, and he didn't live with the family, so he was sort of I guess like a war hero, or like someone who had experienced war, but he
at the very least he experienced it.
He'd done some war. In the 1980s, the family moved to Gothenburg, which again was in Sweden, and the mother was arrested in the 1990s for shoplifting. But other than that, there's not a lot of detail. She may have been in an abusive relationship. There was some some suggestion that she might have had substance abuse issues as well, but again, there's no real clear evidence. It's sort of hearsay. The father was definitely an alcoholic, though. Social services also visited the home and they wrote logs about the family, and they said that goats were roaming around the house. Now, I'm not sure if that is a common Swedish practice, but it sort of sounds like a Carl Pilkington story a little bit.
It's probably the roaming that makes it a problem. Like, it's like, oh, the goats were penned peacefully in their area.
Yeah.
But, like, they're just clomping everywhere.
The verb choice.
Definitely.
Doubts on whether the legitimacy of these goats.
Like, it suggests there's some aimlessness towards these goats. Like, if it's like the goats were heading to their destination via the house, fine. But just roaming, free, like an episode of Come Dine With Me where they're just looking through the bedside tables.
Yeah. But also, the twins were described as quite rude and quite feral as well. They were
just roaming through the goat pen.
They were roaming as well. In the early 80s, their father unfortunately died, probably wasn't helped by the fact he was an alcoholic. And it's around the time the twins were starting secondary school, so that was probably quite a difficult time for them. But again, there's not much about their school age. There's evidence of some absence from school. And then David Kahn described it as they were going through a punky style phase, which he said that they had spiky hair.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it depends how spiky, really.
Depends how high.
Grab emo.
I think after 3 inches, it becomes punk.
Yeah. Well, there was no precise measure of the hair length. And said they probably liked Duran Duran.
Oh, they're not punk.
With basically no evidence for that.
It's just like, that's what he knows. That's what music are the kids listening to these days? It was probably that damn Duran Duran.
I'm not convinced he knows what a punk is. Ursula dropped out of school before she graduated, and then Sabina did finish. And then David Kahn looked at some reports online. So he said that people claimed to have known them, and they said things like that they were rude at school. They were quite aggressive. So they'd like push past you around the school corridors. And if you bumped into them on a night out, you'd try and avoid them. You'd pretend you don't know them, basically. I can see that I always wanted a twin, and I can see why. You've not had the greatest upbringing. You've always got your twin there for company. You don't really need as much of a social scene.
Someone who understands.
You might just not make as much effort with other people. But you've always got that backup. So reports have also stated that Ursula was more normal, in air quotes, than Sabina, but she had a lot of control over her, which conflicts quite a lot with later psychiatric assessments, which suggest that Sabina had control over Ursula. But
they probably just got them mixed up, to be fair. They looked very similar.
Yeah, true.
Twin-like.
Again, not much is known about their 20s, but it is confirmed that they both moved away from Sweden, with Ursula living in America and working as a waitress, which, talking of friends, Ursula, bit ditzy, working as a waitress.
Phoebe's blonde. Sister!
Hello.
Oh my gosh. I think we just unearthed like a massive conspiracy.
Yeah, that was not one of the conspiracy theories I read. And then Sabina moved to Cork in Ireland. And she got a boyfriend and she had 2 children. And she had her first child aged 22, who she called Simon. So she's quite a young mother. And she lived on what some reports say a traveller's camp. So in a sort of a caravan and living in a traveller community. Ursula then travelled to Cork to visit Sabina in 2008. And then during the night, the two ran off into the night, didn't tell anyone they were going, disappeared, and they left, and they travelled to Liverpool by ferry. Once they arrived, they went straight to a police station, and there they told police that they were scared for Sabina's children's safety due to their father, who they'd left the children with, being unsafe to leave the children with.
So they were like, I've left my children with an unfit person. Can you fix it now?
Yeah. But no, there's no explanation of why they went to the UK, why they didn't report it in Ireland.
And they just suddenly got up and like left like in the night, like gone.
Literally, unless they were like planning to escape and run away together, and, you know, maybe Sabina was sick of being a mother.
So that seems like it would be something to do with Ursula, the fact that she's the one that's come over to visit and then they've gone. Like, yeah. She's the catalyst of that, possibly.
It's really, really strange.
This is why people need to keep diaries again.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, just explain, show your work in.
Yeah, exactly. Explain all your actions every day, no matter how mundane, because someday we're going to want to know what it is.
The police, obviously, their response was to phone this guy, or phone the police in Cork and then get someone to drop around the house. And Sabina's boyfriend basically had no idea what they were on about. He didn't know they'd even gone.
Oh.
And he was like, what, they're in England? Like, really confused. And, you know, I think they said that everything was fine. I know they didn't remove any children or anything. So they just went and checked on the kids and left. So the Liverpool police closed the case, said, the Cork police are going to chase this up with you. Stay in touch, keep your phone on you, end of. And they were sort of like, not our problem anymore.
Like, if your girlfriend wants to run away to Liverpool, she can.
Yeah, fine. The twins then got on a coach and they headed down the M6 towards London. But then the coach stopped at Keele Services and they got off. So this wasn't supposed to be a scheduled stop for the bus. No, they didn't change drivers there. They didn't have any reason to stop at Keele Services. It wasn't like a rest stop. They hadn't not long left.
Were they getting kicked off then?
So yeah, well, that's what the BBC documentary said, that the twins had said, we're not going to stow our bags in the underneath where you usually put your bags. And the driver had got suspicious and said, well, let me look in them then, because why are you not letting me store your bags? And they'd refused. So he'd basically stopped and said, get out of the bus then. So that would explain it. David Cann believed that maybe they'd got on the wrong coach and made a fuss about the fact that they were on the wrong coach and made them stop. But I don't see why the BBC documentary would be wrong. So I'm going to go with the bag.
I like that. Just blind faith in the British Broadcasting Corporation. Like, they would never lie to me. How dare they? Yeah. They don't lie about anything.
Never.
Unless it's Jimmy Savile.
Yeah. So from the services, the two, they hung around there for about 2.5 hours.
Nice. Do you remember that time when we were at Milton Keynes coach stop, waiting to get our coach because we were going to America?
Were we there for ages, but then nearly missed the bus?
We were there waiting for the bus for the time that the bus would leave. And then when we got on, they were like, we've been waiting for you. What's happening? What? And the bus driver was really annoyed that we hadn't got on the bus sooner. I was like, it's not supposed to leave till 5:30. Why should we have been on it any earlier than then?
Wasn't it the start of our American adventure as well? We're like, fuck you, we're going on holiday.
Apparently that's coach etiquette, that you have to be on it 30 minutes before it leaves. Whoa. No.
Bullshit.
I can easily see how they got kicked off, to be fair. Yeah. We almost didn't make it on.
Yeah. So they hung around there and then eventually they seemed to get bored. I don't know if they were expecting a coach to come along or something. They were going to get on it. But they got bored and then they started walking along the M6. Now, I know that in some countries it is okay to walk along the motorway, but the UK is not one of them. I always feel awkward when I see a bike on an A road, to be honest. I think that's bad enough. But they were like full on walking along and they walked along, not just the edge, they walked into the middle. So they walked along the central reservation.
No.
Yeah.
That's like the only time people do that is if you've actually lost the plot. That's definitely a sign that you don't give a shit about life anymore.
Yeah. Like in an IT, walking along the motorway. Yes. That's like the ultimate.
The cry for help is the central reservation.
Yeah. So then when they tried to cross the road, they didn't do that well because Sabina was hit by a car, causing minor injuries. People who'd been driving reported this, and this is where the police became aware of these two on the motorway. And the call came in, and then they dispatched a team of sort of highway patrol, and then the motorway cops, as they call them, were sent out as well. And
with obviously the camera crew.
The camera crew went, well, we'll come along with it. So it's two young twins. Sounds like a story.
Yeah.
So the twins later, after this, have explained why they're on the motorway running. They said that they were being chased by rapists/maniacs that had come at them at the service station and they were trying to get away from them, which would explain why they were maybe running, but you wouldn't, you'd report it at the service station. Surely that's much safer than walking along somewhere terrifying and fast.
You wouldn't go down the middle.
Yeah. I don't know if they were seeing things that weren't there, or they were experiencing hallucinations or delusions, but it is, it's really, really strange. So then the motorway cops arrive and they begin to question the two, and the highway patrol are there and they're filling them in, and you can see this all on camera. And I do, you know, if you're at a computer, pause this, type in Ericsson twins motorway cops, and you can watch the whole video, but I'll explain to you what's going on if you haven't, if you're in a car or something. So they're standing there and they're filling them in and saying, oh, they seem to be okay now. They said that they were scared and they were running. They were walking along the motorway. And then sort of at the edge of the screen, you just see there's one man talking to, who was it? Ursula. And then she starts to run towards the road and he goes, no, 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 and grabs her coat. And then she takes the coat off. So he's left holding the coat and just runs full into a lorry, and I think it was going 56 miles an hour, literally straight in front of it. And then Sabina runs out into the road after her, and she's hit by a car. Now, that poor lorry driver.
Yeah.
Imagine.
The thing when watching it is just that you can see that it's not just like she's trying to, she's not trying to get away from the police officer. She's I get the impression she's determined to run into traffic.
Yeah, because she's standing there totally calm one minute.
She's standing there talking to him and then just suddenly darts. And it's not, if you were running away, you'd run. I think it looks like you're trying to get hit.
She wasn't shouting before.
Like they wanted to commit suicide is the impression that it gives, because it just is so forceful that she's going for the, to be hit. She's not trying to look or dodge, just gone.
So obviously the reaction of the police there, they're like, holy shit. And as watching it is really shocking, because it's not something that you see. I'm sure that the people filming it thought jackpot a little bit, because it's not sort of your everyday occurrence, but so unexpected. So Ursula is, she's literally been run over by this lorry. So she is unable to get up. She's lying on the ground. Her legs are crushed, but she is conscious. Sabina is unconscious on the road, having been hit by the car. And you sort of see her get thrown across, you know, meters.
They were so lucky that they didn't get properly crushed. Like, they sort of managed to get away quite lightly, to say they ran into oncoming traffic. Yeah. It's probably because they might have been driving slightly slower, trying to rubberneck at what the motorway cops were doing anyway.
So then police stop traffic and they call for medical aid. And Ursula, still conscious, she won't let them anywhere near her. She's screaming, she's scratching, she's spitting at them. Now she's not on camera. The cameras start to focus on Sabina because she starts coming around. But while she's there, it's reported that she was accusing the police of not being real. She's saying, you know, I know you're not real. So that suggests there's some sort of delusion or hallucination. Then Sabina wakes up and she shouts, they're going to steal your organs. Then she gets up shouting for the police. She says, I need police. And they're there saying, I am the police. And this woman is, she's just been standing over Sabina and she's been saying, don't worry, stay calm. You've been in an accident, don't worry. And then she starts getting up and the woman's like, I need some help. And I think she's saying like, where's Glenn? And then Sabina starts running towards the centre of the road and into the other side of the traffic. And they're like, no, running after her. So they think, fuck, not again.
So she's already been hit by a car. And then got up and ran into traffic again.
Now, I think the other side of the traffic is going slow now because it's been stopped on one side. People are, again, like you said, nosing at what's going on. And then they stop the traffic on the other side. And then the police start trying to apprehend her and trying to stop her from obviously hurting herself or anyone else. She smacked the woman in the face as well. Like, square in the face. And then members of the public just start coming out of the car and helping and grabbing her. One guy is a retired policeman.
Oh, nice.
So they're like, jackpot. And they grab her and they restrain her. And she's so strong. So she tries to fight with the police. It takes 7 people to get her down and handcuffs. And she's shouting, fuck off, the entire time. Fuck off, get off me.
That's like crazy strength. 7 people to take her down.
That's like, and the policewoman said, I've never seen anyone have that much strength unless they're on drugs of some sort.
And she's just been injured as well. She shouldn't even be able to stand up.
It's so shocking. So a helicopter comes and they airlift Ursula to hospital because obviously she's the most injured, she can't walk. And then they take Sabina to hospital and she calms down. She's looked over, but she's not really harmed despite being hit so hard. She made a massive dent in this car. And she's released 5 hours later. Now, she's not released straight out into the public. She's then taken to a police station where she's charged with assault of an officer. But they filmed that for the Motorway Cops programme and they put this in the BBC documentary. So I watched this part and she's so calm. She's not asking about her sister. She's having a joke. She's sort of flirting a bit with the officers. Seems really chilled. Sort of saying, oh, you know, bad things happen in threes. Probably something else is going to happen now. But sort of rationalising it.
Like she hadn't even been there. Like,
she was a victim. Like something had happened to her.
Yeah, like
not explaining what she'd done in any way. She didn't seem bothered about being charged with assaulting a police officer. She did seem a bit bothered about how her hair looked and what clothes they were going to give her. But other than that, she's sort of not really bothered about anything. They did drug and drink tests on both of them. No drugs, no drink.
No drugs either of them.
Absolutely none. So they contacted Sabina's boyfriend and told him what had happened. He's just confused because he's like, I thought they were in Liverpool. Now they've suddenly been in some car accident. So he can, but it's not like he said, oh yeah, well, they've been in this cult, or oh yeah, well, yeah, they've been planning a suicide. Like there's no, he doesn't give them any information.
We don't know any history of any other sort of manic episodes or anything
nothing. So Sabina was given a day in police custody. So she stays there overnight and then she's released the next day. And they let her go with a bag of her belongings. So she's got some cigarettes that she bought duty free on the ferry over, and then she's got her clothes and she's wearing some of her sister's clothes. So she begins to try to find her sister in hospital, but she sort of wanders around a bit aimlessly. So she's not able to find a hospital. So she's seen by 2 blokes. So there's 54-year-old Glenn Hollinshead and his friend Peter Malloy. 2 average blokes, just been at the pub, wandering home, and she goes over to them. So he's got a dog. He's taking his dog to the pub with them. And she says, oh, that's a cute dog, and then goes over and pets it. And then she starts to tell them that she's lost and she's looking for a sister who she thinks is in hospital, and she's not really sure where how she's going to get there, and do they know if there's anywhere she can stay tonight? Is there like a B&B or something? And they say, I mean, I don't know if this is a bit of a line. They say, oh, there's no B&B around here. So
she obviously needs help, wouldn't she? Want to help out.
I think Glenn thought she was either homeless or fleeing from domestic violence and wanted to help her.
Yeah, so, even her actual story of just that she's lost, she would have spoken with an accent, I guess.
Yeah.
You could have told that she wasn't from around there.
True, yeah. So he says, come back to mine and I'll give you some food and we'll help you find your sister. So at Glenn's house, so Peter goes back as well. They've bought some beer. They all go back together. Peter asked Sabina about her sister, and he was talking on the documentary, so it's quite interesting to see what he says about her, his experience. And he says, oh, so your sister's in hospital, what happened then? And she gets really cagey, she won't answer his questions, she doesn't want to talk about it. But she just keeps getting up and looking out of the curtains and looking sort of quite suspicious, as if she's checking to see if someone's watching her.
Mm.
So they again think maybe it's domestic violence, maybe she's fleeing from an abusive relationship. So that makes them want to be more supportive and more sort of accommodating and help her out, because you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I can imagine.
You just think,
Luke and I coming across someone, we'd probably just do everything we could to help them. So she's got some cigarettes and she's smoking them, sort of chain smoking. And then she offers them cigarettes and they say, thank you, yeah. And then put them in their mouths and she snatches them out and says, no, you can't have them, they might be poisoned. So again, I don't know if there's some sort
very
of...
very erratic.
Yeah. Considering that she's just
obviously not
it.
Sure about what's real and what's not, having yeah. real trouble distinguishing between reality and fiction, massively.
Absolutely. So she left the house for 10 minutes and she made a call, which isn't actually, this is in the book by David Camber. It's not in the documentary and it's not in the articles. But she reportedly phoned the police constable, Paul, and asked about her sister, which again, it seems more rational than it seems. Yeah. Seems fair enough. He said he offered to collect her and take her to see Ursula. And maybe take the people that she's with as well if she wanted. And she says, no, I'm too tired. Which I think is quite surprising, considering she was trying to find Ursula. She was worried about her.
Or is that she's starting to lose trust in who she's on the phone to. You know, if she's yeah. this paranoid and this suspicious about people, she might have thought maybe it wasn't him. Maybe true. It wasn't a police yeah. officer.
So then Peter left the house about 11:30 to go home. And Sabina stays at Glenn's. And then... the next day, Glenn phones his brother because he says to Sabina, look, I'll try and help you find out about Ursula. My brother works at the hospital. So I can say, when you go in for your shift today, could you just make a point of finding out what's going on and how she is? So he agrees to find out what he can for them. Then Glenn's neighbour around lunchtime is outside and he's washing his minibus. And Glenn comes out and he asks for tea bags. And the neighbour says... I'll get some after I've done with the minibus, obviously. Don't want a half-clean minibus. So Glenn goes into the house, and then literally 1 minute later, he comes out clutching himself and says, she stabbed me. And he is bleeding really, really seriously. And he says, I'm dying. And then the neighbour in the interview, it's the way he responds. I'm sorry to laugh because this is tragic and horrific. But he just says, oh, I said to him, oh, no, you're not. Oh, no, it can't be. I saw you. Like, just his response.
I think
is
he thought
really...
he was just taking the piss because he didn't have any tea bags. He's like, I'm dying for a cup of tea.
Maybe. But it's like, he's so blasé about it. But even after he knows the outcome of this,
oh, you'll be right.
Change your story. So then he falls to the floor, and this is heartbreaking. He says to his neighbour, will you look after my dog? And aww. Then he dies. And he was stabbed five times. Horrific. And I had no idea, because I knew about this motorway cop's footage. I just thought, that's weird, I'll never find out about that. No idea that she went on
to murder someone
literally the next day.
But that's just more evidence that she doesn't know what is real and what isn't. Because this is the guy that's taken her in and helped her. And she obviously thinks that he's out to get her. It must be feeling threatened. She's not trying to steal money. She's not trying to do anything else. It's just seems like it's pure like paranoia.
Totally. So Sabina runs from the house and she's got a lump hammer on her. And he was a welder. So it's... likely that it was a tool from his house that he would have hanging around. But I thought, well, okay, fair enough, protection. She's scared. She starts smashing herself in the head with it.
Fuck.
So, I mean, this is extreme.
That's why. So, yeah, maybe she wasn't, like, say, on the motorway. They were actually trying to kill themselves. Maybe she thinks it's like Inception, where you have, like, some sort of weird dream thing where you have to die to get out of it.
Yeah, but boat...
smashing herself in the
head. I've not seen Inception.
Well, Inception, if you die in the dream, you die in real life, I think. No, that's not true. I'm confused. I'm still confused and I'm trying to explain.
This is why I haven't watched Inception.
But that's the thing, isn't it? Like, you go into a dream, how do you wake yourself up from it?
I don't know. But for both of them to...
for her to be smashing her own head in with a hammer, something's going on in there that she wants to stop.
Oh, yeah. But what? Literally what? Somebody tell me. Answers on a postcard. Because I need to know. I need to know. So this guy's driving past. He sees her whacking at herself in the head with a hammer. He gets out. He tries to apprehend her. He tries to get the hammer off her. She's got a roof tile in her pocket. So she grabs that out.
Where the fuck do you get that from?
And she smacks him in the head with that. And she runs off. But then he sees paramedics running after her. Because Glenn's neighbour by now has obviously called the police. And they're on the lookout for her. And paramedics start running after her. So she runs onto a bridge over the A50, which is quite a busy road, and she jumps off and she falls 40 feet, breaks both ankles and fractures her skull.
She's a fucking cyborg.
But like,
I mean, no, she's fractured some bones now, but how has she been hit by a lorry and jumped off a fucking motorway bridge and she's still alive?
It is like an action movie where you're like, oh yeah, as if they wouldn't be dead by now. But she's literally...
Yeah.
A lorry.
Tough.
A lorry. Bird. But,
I'm loving the name checks of all these British roads as well.
Down the A50.
Shout out to the M46.
But even like, do you know, like if you're on a bridge, like to be able to throw yourself out, to not have that thing in your head that makes you go, yeah, I'm probably not going to do this. You have to really sort of turn off that kind of ability to protect yourself.
Yeah, some synapses aren't firing in the right way.
Yeah. So she is taken to hospital. Ursula spends 3 months in hospital and she then moves back to Sweden. And Sabina is obviously tried with murder. Now she pleads guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility. And during questioning, she responded no comment to everything. Her defence counsel argued, folie à deux. Let me show you.
Yeah, folie à deux.
Yeah, so shared psychosis, which is not part of the DSM and only has a handful of cases. This one being the top one, which makes me suspicious.
Isn't Ian and Myra another one?
Were they psychotic though? I mean, they knew what they were doing, didn't they?
That you can convince someone else to do it. Yeah, shared, I suppose it's not really shared psychosis, is it?
Whereas this is sort of, the argument is that
they both were able to believe that same.
Some sort of delusion that was the same. The only other case that they had that I found an interesting one, it was one being a husband and wife who believed someone was coming into their house, spreading dust and wearing down their shoes. Which I can fucking believe. My house, I don't know where all the dust in my house is coming from. And
someone spreading dust around.
I feel like I'm constantly replacing the soles of my shoes. So I'm sharing this psychosis. This is a folie à trois.
Why, who else is involved?
Me.
Yeah, but trois, three.
Yeah, these husband and wife.
Oh, they've roped you in. Yeah. You read about it and you're there.
I'm down for their theory.
So, okay, I want to join in. Folie à quatre.
Done. So her plea was accepted by Nottingham Crown Court and she was given 5 years in prison.
For murdering a human.
For manslaughter. So she served that time in Surrey and she became a Christian in prison. And a lot of people have said that is not enough. I was looking into this. In fact, I was talking to a student earlier about psychology, obviously. But also...
Well done.
We're talking about... ghosts, and he was saying about how it's interesting sort of thinking about ghosts because it's the unexplainable. And I said, I don't find ghosts that interesting, because my answer to ghosts is someone saying, oh, I think I saw a ghost. My answer is, no, you didn't. Or prove it. They can't prove it. And it's, no, you didn't. But whereas this, something's going on. The evidence is there. I just want to know what's going on. Like, it's not like something that I can't... It's something that I can't explain, but that I know is real.
Yeah.
But I feel like, unless it's sort of evidence-based, I'm not really interested these days. Sort of to my own detriment, I'm not interested in sort of the supernatural and the other side as much as maybe I could be.
And like, to your own detriment, as if like, because I don't believe in ghosts, I'm so much worse off.
I just feel like it makes me... not an open...
Less interesting?
Yeah. It makes me not an open person. But then, there are those people who go around saying they're spiritual, and it's like, no, you bought some baggy trousers and a floral crown for Primark. Like, that's not spiritual.
Hashtag deep.
So, these are some theories anyway. You can tell me what you think about why these two did what they did. So one theory is temporary insanity that was transferred from one sister to the other through their twin bond.
Okay.
What are you thinking about that one?
Truthies? I think temporary insanity, great. Transferred via the twin bond. I don't know. I guess that could be a thing. I don't know if it's... I don't think there's any evidence for the twin bond. I'm sure I've seen stuff that proves that there is almost zero evidence. Like, there's no twin bond. But I
you
guess,
just spent a lot of time together.
I think
together.
Just in the same way as if, like, it's really hard to call someone they're crazy. Like, if you were... wanted to run down the street and you're like, someone's after me, I'd probably run along with you.
Yeah, maybe.
Just be like I don't believe it too, but I'll
Would
join
you
in. Just...
Run into a motorway, though.
I don't know. Like, maybe one of them believed the other one, like, believed what she was saying was true. You know, if she said, like, I'm in trouble, the police are after me, like, there's a conspiracy, like, and they told you all this stuff and you knew them and trusted them. Maybe you would.
We have seen,
like, in the one
con man get away
with
like
it. In that Henry Freeguard, he had multiple people living really shitty lives because he convinced them they were being watched. Like gang stalking, like that's a really interesting, like, it really blurs the line between like what's a psychological problem and what's real, where people believe that they're being gang stalked and like they can see the evidence of it everywhere. Oh, that car drove past me twice, or that person looked at me. That person looked at me on the tube. Like, you can see evidence of it if you're open to it. I don't know.
Yeah, so possibility. So
possible.
The second one, they were possessed by an evil spirit who worked through them. And then by becoming Christians, they were saved from the evil spirit. And therefore, that's why it stopped.
Not possible.
Nope. Someone else killed Glenn. So apparently the wounds showed there were two attackers, suggested by some people. And... that is evidence that Sabina was part of a cult, which is why their bags couldn't be searched and they thought the police were fake.
But if they were
running from something.
I don't know. Because you could be part of a cult and they could still brainwash you to believe that kind of bullshit too.
Yeah. But then you'd think that people would say, oh yeah, they were part of this cult, or they went to these meetings, or they were talking to these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were in an experiment done on twins which impacted on their mind and used mind control.
Possibly.
Like the Unibomber.
Yeah.
We're going with that one.
Yeah.
Ding, ding, we've got a winner.
Yeah, Unibomber theory. The government fucked them up. It wasn't his fault. It was his fault, but he wasn't to blame.
Okay.
He just wants to destroy everything.
He murdered innocent people.
He just wanted to be left alone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call. Click Grainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So, I'm now going to be talking to you in today's lecture about George Joseph Smith. His name might be familiar to some of you and not to others. And to some of you, it will just sound like every other person that we've done on this podcast because he's British and we have 20 acceptable names in rotation.
He's got a similar name to the guy who founded Mormonism, is that right? That was
Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Maybe that's why it sounds familiar.
So this George Smith, he was born in London's East End in January of 1872. And as a boy, he had clearly very challenging behaviour. It's not quite clear why it happened, but he was sent to Gravesend Reformatory for 8 years from the time that he was 9 years old. So almost for the entirety of his education, he was in a reform school for baddens.
Oh, is that what they called it? Reform school?
Yeah. So no doubt growing up in a place like that would have had a huge influence on his life, and he would almost certainly have picked up some tips and tricks, if not at the very least developing a disdain for authority and the law and not really liking people in charge.
Opposite of authoritarian personality.
So when he was allowed out, he did return to go and live with his mother initially, and she did take him in, but their relationship was massively strained, and his first wife reported that he'd basically broken his mother's heart and that she was just devastated. So George Smith was not really in any way concerned with the feelings of women in his life. He knew that he was an attractive man, and he understood that he had power over women and that he could control them either with the suggestion or the offer of marriage.
Oh, I thought you could say sex then. There's another time.
No, well, see, that's the difference. Like, although he would sleep with them, it was definitely he used marriage as the tool, because in the earlier 20th century, suffrage was still in its early stages, and women would need to be married in order to secure their standing, to get emancipation from their parents. There was so much that they couldn't do for themselves without being owned by a man. So he knew that if he picked the right women, women who were just sort of on the cusp of like being old enough to be on the shelf, but young enough to be believable, that he could want to marry me, and they would just jump at it. From the time he left the reformatory at 18 to the time that he first married at the age of 26. George Smith was constantly in pursuit of an easy lifestyle by criminal means. He had many spells in jail for theft, and then he realised that he could sort of combine his powers together to...
This sounds like kids' TV. Combine their powers together when their rings unite.
Like a creepy mustachio transformer. Basically, he could persuade women to do the thieving for him, and then... he really doesn't have to do anything, particularly by getting women to rob their employers, women in service, things like that. So I'm sure he tried that a few times, but it was in 1896 that he was jailed for a year over a particular scheme where he was charged with larceny and the receiving of stolen goods. And then when he was released from that, he went to live in Leicester, where in 1898 he married his first wife and his only fully legal wife, Caroline Thornhill. She was the daughter of a bootmaker, and he thoroughly disapproved of his 18-year-old marrying this man who was going by the name now of George Love.
Oh, that's a...
You have to like
a little message.
Give a little wink when you say that. So Caroline would... Subliminal is like the most overt. I'm George, let me stick my penis in you. So... Caroline would go on in later life to say that she'd never known him do a day's work. And it was clear from the other women that he went on to seduce that his appeal was sort of, it was been described as like hypnotic. And one theory was put about in the press at the time of his trial, some 20 years later, was literally that he had he had the power of hypnotism to get women to do what he wanted. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it's more a case of the systems of the time, the oppression of women meant that being married was better than not.
Like, there are some people, though, that have just got a way about them, haven't they, that you just want to watch?
I think he was charismatic. They said that he had dark little eyes that looked into you. And you do have people that you just don't know why, but you'd do anything for them. So... soon after he and Caroline were married, the now Mr. and Mrs. Love moved to London, where he basically began pimping her out, but as a maid. So he would just constantly he'd be writing references for her, getting her jobs at places, and then instruct her to steal from the families who employed her. This scheme came to an end after about a year of this, when Caroline was caught trying to pawn some silver spoons that she'd stolen in Hastings. And she was sent to prison for 1 year, which seemed to be what she needed to break the spell of her husband that he had over her. And when she came out of prison, she sort of fingered, is that a term that people use? Like identified George Smith for his
She fingered George Smith.
She fingered him in the metaphorical asshole. But she identified him for his part in these crimes, which caused him, which was, I think, was quite progressive
at
the
it.
Time.
Snitch on
but
it.
He was jailed for 2 years for the receipt of the stolen goods. So they obviously recognized that he was the mastermind behind this. And Caroline was then able to escape by emigrating to Canada.
Oh, bloody hell. She wants to get away. She bloody gets massively. Away.
George Smith reportedly went to Leicester on his release to find his Mrs. Love, but her family apparently chased him out of town. And wouldn't say where she was. His pride was only dented slightly, and his heart couldn't have been broken because whilst Caroline had been in prison initially for those 12 months, he had married a woman who was the keeper of a boarding house in London. Now, in the original trial notes, her name's withdrawn, but it's thought that they didn't really have much of a marital relationship, that he just married her and then would just show up at intervals demanding money from her. So this was his first bigamous marriage. And bigamy, obviously, where you marry more than one person at once, it's still against the law and is punishable for a maximum of 7 years for that. I mean, obviously, there is polygamy, which is permissible in some places, which is where you have one wife and then you have lots of girlfriends.
But
you don't legally marry all of them. Which
I mean,
I think
you could just have a party if you wanted, like say this is marriage number two.
Like we'll all live together.
If you keep it on the down low, he's gonna give a shit.
I think it's sort of fine to keep that as a law because I think it protects people from being scammed in the same way. If you can legally marry, I guess you could marry someone and then break that promise and go and marry someone else.
Or go around divorcing. Like I could be married to Luke, but then go marry a rich guy and divorce him and get his money.
Or just not even divorce him, just have like a double life.
Yeah, yeah.
But fine. Like if you're all in the know, it's cool. So this was certainly not a setback in the life of George Smith that he'd lost his life and gone to jail because he'd discovered his winning formula for being able to live a comfortable life without doing any work whatsoever. So in 1908 is the next recorded account of his movements as like a professional leech. So he met a widow named Florence Wilson in the June of 1908, who he married after only 3 weeks of dating. And on the 3rd of July, the couple went on a date to see the Franco-British exhibition at White City. So while they were there, he just left her for a moment saying that he was going to go and buy a paper, but never came back. So while his unsuspecting wife was waiting for him to return from the shop, he gone home, removed all her belongings from their house and sold them and just fucked off.
Oh.
Horrendous. The worst type of ghosting. Like, oh, I'll be back in a second. All your belongings are gone. Like,
yeah,
totally fucked her over.
Do they leave you hanging?
And that's such a quick turnaround. Everything. Like if they met in June, dated for 3 weeks, he left her the 3rd of July. Literally, he did this. They got married. He did it straight away. He didn't even try and like, lure her in with a couple of weeks of happily married life. But as soon as that paper was signed, right, you're gone. So the 30th of July, same year, so only 3 weeks after he's done this, he met a woman called Edith Pegler in Bristol. And he married her using his real name, George Smith again, after she'd responded to an advert in a newspaper that he was looking for a housekeeper. Now, Edith is a slightly different figure in his life. He didn't use her in quite the same way as his other wives. He told her that he was an antiques dealer and that he'd have to go away on business for long periods of time. And she just became used to the fact that her husband would be gone for weeks or months. He would tell her that he'd gone abroad. And basically, if she ran out of money because he hadn't come back for a long time, she'd just go and stay with her mum and wait for him to come back. So they had
just accept the nature that you get. Like, I always think when Luke's home from work, he could be having a full-on other relationship. If he left work early every day, spent an hour or two with someone else, he could be coming home.
Yeah. Well, if he's gone for a couple of months because she thinks he's in Paris, he's fucking married someone. Yeah, he's married someone, dumped them, sold their belongings, and then come back to her.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Edith, he continued to come back to in between all the other women. He never sold her stuff. He never ditched her, but he would keep coming back for some strange reason. But yet she didn't know what he was doing. I don't know, maybe she was just like the best cook. Like, fuck, I need to go back for a Sunday dinner. Or he cared about her genuinely. Yeah. But either way, he kept her on the string while he used other women. So in 1909, George Smith married a Miss Sarah Freeman, using this time the still romantic name George Rose. And he explained his wealth but lack of employment by saying that he had a benevolent rich aunt. I've never said the word aunt before in my life.
Auntie.
So once they'd settled in London together, he told her that he needed some ready cash to be able to set up his antiques business. So Sarah went ahead and withdrew all of her savings from the post office, as well as selling some government stocks that she had, handed everything over to her husband. So on the 5th of November that year, so they'd been married for less than a month, he took her out for a day at the National Gallery. And whilst they were there, he excused himself to go to the toilet and just did another runner.
Why does he have to be married to them to do this? Is that because they have to live together?
It's because then he can have all their money.
Okay.
Because then he's in charge of their accounts, right, pretty much. So then he, and so they can live together too, because they wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
The rich, fancier people wouldn't have. So he left his wife waiting again. She just thought he was going to the toilet. She sat there waiting forever. And there's no mobile phone, so you can't text them, like, where the fuck are you? Like, you'd have to wait for a really long time before you gave up.
Yeah. Knock on the door, like...
And, like, go to the police office, like, where can they be? I've lost them. Like, you just end up staying in the same place, hoping they come back to you. So he yet again emptied their flat of everything to sell it off. And it's thought that he would have made a total of around £400 from Miss Freeman, which at the time would have been about an average working man's wage for about 4 years.
Bloody hell.
So, exactly. Bloody hell. You'd be like, right, you've got 4 years worth of income now. You can chill for a little bit.
Yeah.
And it would satiate a lot of people's appetites. But George Smith had this idea that he was going to be a fantastic businessman and an entrepreneur. And he bought a secondhand furniture shop in Southend for him and Edith to live above and run, which seems quite sensible. If you're going to be stealing a lot of women's furniture and then you've got somewhere to get rid, sell it. He also bought 8 houses in Bristol back there. But I think, unsurprisingly, his reformatory education hadn't really prepared him for this life of legitimate business. And so he ended up failing a lot of things. He sold all his properties at a loss because he just really couldn't be asked to deal with them. And so by 1910, he needed some more money again. So August 1910, so he's only had this for about, I don't know, 8 months, and already it's gone. Bessie Mundy, so her full name is Beatrice, but she was known as Bessie. Bessie Mundy was living in Clifton. And her father had died some years before, and she'd been left with a small fortune, but it was in a family trust that her uncle looked after.
Did he marry the uncle?
That would have been good, wouldn't it? Add some diversity to this thing. But she was age 31, so she was the perfect target for George Smith. It's very like the Garfunkel and Oates song about 29, 31.
There's nobody left.
Exactly.
I'm all alone.
Exactly. You just tip over into that edge and she's like, oh my God. And especially in this time, that would have been very much, you're running out of time. It's probably not going to happen for you. So when she met George Smith, he was calling himself Henry Williams and he was posing as a picture restorer. And within a week or so, they'd eloped together to Weymouth. So literally a matter of days. And they married there in a registry office. That night, Bessie wrote a letter to her uncle from the boarding house they were staying in. She just basically sent a note home saying, FYI, I got married. My husband's
suck it, bitches.
Yeah. My husband's going to write a letter of his own to you. like look out for it. So he did write a letter to the uncle also, and it was also quite a short note, and it asked her uncle to, quote, forward as much money as possible at your earliest.
Straight away, write to me.
Hi, I'm Henry. I married Bessie. Give me in as much money as you can, quick. It's pretty much it. Obviously, they didn't really want to. So in December, Smith received £135, which was the interest from the fund. And knowing, I think he knowing that that was about all he was going to get, it's still quite a big sum of money.
Still quite a bit.
He fucked off. So knowing that Bessie was wealthy, her family was quite protective of her because they hadn't just given everything over, he wanted to make sure that she wasn't going to do anything. And he thought the best way to do it was to humiliate her into keeping quiet. So he left a letter for Bessie explaining that he was leaving because he'd caught a disease from her, which he said was, quote, which is called the bad disorder, end quote. And therefore, it proved that she'd been sleeping around before they got married.
What?
He then said that he was going to leave.
He could have just said syphilis.
Yeah, right. He couldn't even. Like, he didn't even know the name of one.
Bad disorder.
Yeah. So he said that for his health and honour, the cure is going to take years and he was going to have to leave. And so then it gets better. So in to make sure that her relatives, who probably weren't as gullible as Bessie, would say, that's bullshit. If you're saying you didn't have sex before marriage, you've not given him a disease, whatever, and came looking for him, especially knowing that he had the £35, he told her to try and put them off, to say that she lost the £135 because she'd had it all in her handbag and then she went to the beach and fell asleep and it got stolen.
My colleague went to Magaluf this weekend. She looked like shit today. she went on swimming in the beach and
she get shit stolen.
Her bag got stolen.
Oh my God, actually this.
Yeah, actually this.
I mean, to be fair, she went swimming, so she literally just left her bag to the masses.
Yeah.
Didn't fall asleep.
Although I have fallen asleep on many a beach.
I can't fall asleep anywhere.
You can't fall asleep on a beach.
I can't even fall asleep on a sofa.
Shit.
Yeah, it's hard.
That's my
times.
Number one snoozing spot.
It's thought that Smith then returned to Edith in Bristol. And then together they used the money they'd got from Bessie to buy another house in Southend. I think he probably tried funding their lifestyle with more bigamous marriages for the next couple of years. But the next major event happened in Weston-super-Mare in 1912 when Smith was spending a day by the sea and bumped into his ex-wife, Bessie Mundy. So
she told her family this story about the money stolen. She went along with this.
Yeah, she said, he's had to leave me. My money's been stolen. Everything's really sad. And he's been able to ghost all these women before. And now, fuck, I've bumped into one again. What's he going to do? So he's sort of just trapped into this awkward situation. So he just pretended, oh my God, I've been looking for you for ages. Like, last thing she knew, he left her at a gallery. He basically said that he was really sorry. He was cured and then he'd been searching for her. He knew her family were in Weymouth. That's the whole reason he's here. He wanted to recognize. Absolute just thinking on the feet. Crap. Here you are.
It is sort of sitcom-y, isn't it?
Yeah,
that moment where you see the cogs turning.
Bessie took him back to her boarding house and told the good news to her landlady, who was called Mrs. Tuckett. And Mrs. Tuckett seems a bit more switched on, and she was unimpressed that this long lost Mr. Williams had just turned up. And so she said, look, it's my duty, I'm gonna have to send for Bessie's auntie straight away to come and speak to you both. Like, this isn't right.
Good work.
So then the pair were like, okay, we're just going out for dinner. And then they didn't come back. They didn't even get Bessie's belongings. They just said, we'll see you later, and then disappeared completely. They then spent a lot of time moving about while Smith looked for some legal advice on how to gain control of Bessie's full trust fund. So he was eventually told by a solicitor that basically the only way to guarantee that he'd get possession of this trust fund would be if they both made wills, leaving everything to each other, and she died.
Oh, that's bad advice.
So there you go, decision made. He knew now he couldn't keep bumping. He couldn't keep doing this and then risk bumping into them again. And if he really wants to get hold of everything they've got, they're going to have to die. So 8th of July, the wills were made. 9th of July, Smith purchased a bathtub from an ironmonger. 10th of July, he took his wife to the doctors for a checkup after claiming that she'd suffered a fit.
But Bessie's, what, he just told her?
Yeah.
Oh my God, you just had a fit.
Yeah, pretty much. That's she woke so up and he said, up. Oh my God, didn't you realise what happened last night? She didn't remember that anything had happened. She said, well, I
guess she might not.
She said, oh, I've got a bit of a headache. And he was like, no, yeah, you collapsed. And like, he convinced her that she'd had a fit.
That's terrifying.
So then Smith summoned doctors to the house in the middle of the night to come and see Bessie about the fits. And he said, right, you'd best write to your uncle now and explain that you're having a breakdown and that you're leaving everything to me because otherwise he won't believe me if something happens. So she did. She wrote a letter saying that I'm really ill and, by the way, my husband's going to get everything.
She needs a switched on best friend.
Yep. Well, this is what happens when you isolate someone from their family, from their friends, from everyone. Yeah. That's a classic cult move, isn't it? To just isolate people. So in the Sunday morning, she went to take a bath while her husband went out to buy some fish. And the doctor was sent for once again, this time to say that Bessie had had a fit in the bath and drowned. So the doctor arrived to find her lying on her back in the bath and a bar of soap still clutched in her hand. But so after this, Smith moved really swiftly. There was no inquest. They said, okay, it's death by misadventure. And he had the body buried in a common grave before any of Bessie Mundy's family could get there. And he then got the bath and took it back to the shop where he got it from to get his money back.
God.
Not that foolish. So her family did contest the will. But £2,500 was eventually given over to Smith because she had made that will, like it was nothing he could do about it. After which he once again returned to Edith and they moved, living in various places around the Somerset area still. So 1913, George Smith was off again. This time he was in Southsea, where he used his real name and we just didn't really care much now. And he married 25-year-old Alice Burnham. So the day before their wedding, Alice had her life insured for £500, withdrew all her savings, and took £104 from Alice's father that he'd been saving for her marriage and gave it all to her husband. On the 10th of December, so he did hang around with her for a bit longer, Alice and George went to Blackpool on a little holiday in fucking December, though. Come on.
That's no fun for anyone.
But they went up to Blackpool in December looking for somewhere to stay. They hadn't booked anywhere. How would you even book anywhere in advance? Write a letter. Would you write a letter to a hotel saying, can we come and stay tonight?
Oh, I guess so.
Or were they all just like drop-ins?
Maybe you'd write
they had
a letter.
They had telephones.
1912.
Yeah, they had a telephone. Anyway, so Alice, I bet not everyone would have had a telephone. When I worked in the jewellers, 2007, the policy was that if I was taking details of someone for a jewellery repair, they were like, you have to ask them, are you on the telephone?
No.
Before taking the number. I was like, I'm not going to ask someone, are they on the telephone? I'm going to ask them for their number.
Are you on the telephone?
I was like, why can keep going with this practice from how long ago?
Yeah,
are you on the telephone? Yes. They're fucking wired up to the moon these days. It's fine. So anyway, they went to Blackpool and they were looking for somewhere to stay. So they went to one hotel boarding house first and there was room there. But this isn't really going to suit us because there's no bath.
Oh, fuck.
So then they found a second lodging house that did meet the requirements.
Having a murder weapon within it.
Exactly. A doctor was called out to check on Alice. She'd had a headache and he was concerned that she might be going to have a fit.
I mean, you can convince someone that they've had a headache. Someone says headache to me, I get a headache.
Yeah. But obviously the doctor was like, well, you've just had a really long train journey from Portsmouth up to Blackpool, so you just need to chill out about it. So 2 days later, the 12th of December, Alice went for a bath. And the landlady was downstairs in the room below this. And she noticed the ceiling was becoming damp and the bath must have been overflowing. Just as she was about to go and do something about it, George Smith burst in, holding two eggs. And he said, oh, I just nipped out to get these eggs for breakfast.
And I thought I'd come and show you.
Yeah. He then, I mean, what else are you going to have with them? Why are you just buying the eggs? Yeah. Then he went upstairs and began shouting for help because his wife wasn't waking up and wasn't responsive. So once again, a really quick inquest declared death by misadventure, and Alice was buried in a common grave, her belongings sold, and Smith was reunited with Edith and £500 richer.
So what was his misadventure that they were thinking?
They had a bath and they fell asleep, or they had a bath died and she
because
had
of the bath. Just yeah. So she drowned.
It was like
drowned.
An accidental death. Yeah. So then, at the outbreak of World War I in 1914, Smith told Edith he was going to London for a few days, where he quickly wooed and married a servant girl.
Of course.
Called Alice Revel. And he told this girl that his name was Charles Oliver James, but this time decided to go down a slightly easier route of just stealing her savings and ditching her in a public place. He just left her in a park this time. He stole many of her belongings and he took some of them back to Edith as gifts and said, I got all these women's dresses in the sale.
I mean, she's probably been saving her whole life.
Yeah, this was just a girl who worked in service. She wouldn't have had much. I think it's just if he thinks that he can get them.
Yeah.
So this slight break in routine doesn't mean that his murderous ways were over just yet. So December of that year, he married. I mean, he must have got a lot of use out of his wedding suit.
Yeah.
He probably knew all the best vendors. Yeah, same speech.
Literally just the names crossed out and written like a line of names underneath.
Yeah. So he married in December that year, 1914, a Miss Margaret Lofty. She was a 38-year-old vicar's daughter, and this time he called himself John Lloyd and said that he was an estate agent. So he repeated exactly the same pattern, took out life insurance, had a doctor come to visit, made her write letters to her family, got in the bath. He nipped out to the shop claiming he was going to buy something, rushes home at the exact moment that his wife has died accidentally in the bath, drowned. He would then bury her quickly and hotfoot it back to Edith. Just completely the same. So this time, the tragic story of a bride drowning in the bath made it into the newspaper, The News of the World. Alice Burnham's father and the landlady from Blackpool both read the article.
Shit.
And they noticed the glaring similarities between the death of Alice Burnham and Margaret Lofty. And both of them contacted the police. So when George Smith went to his solicitor to collect the money from Margaret Lofty's life insurance on the 1st of February 1915, he was arrested as he left the building. He admitted that he was John Lloyd and George Smith, that he'd married Alice Burnham, and he was just initially charged with bigamy. He'd admitted that he was married to her. That carries a prison sentence. They can investigate all they want now that he is charged with the bigamy.
They've got 7 years to do it.
Yeah. So the bodies of Bessie, Alice and Margaret were examined by Dr. Spilsbury, who I've mentioned in another case. He was an incredibly famous court pathologist. And I know that I've mentioned him before, but I can't remember which one it was. But one of the books that I read about this was called The Magnificent Spilsbury and the Case of the Brides in the Bath by Jane Robbins, which is really interesting. Read. So this Dr. Spilsbury, he examined the bodies, and George was initially charged with the willful murder of all three of them. Now, there's some weird thing in the law at this time where you could only be tried for the murder of, unless it's still now, you can only be tried for one murder at once at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was willful murder.
So I think, mainly, I think it doesn't say, I'm just speculating, but I'm sure, I think it must have been to save expenses. They only tried him for the murder of Bessie Mundy. But they allowed, the judge allowed the evidence of Margaret Lofty and Alice Burnham's murders to be included to establish a pattern for the crimes.
That seems so
But I think once
weird.
They know that he killed that one, they'll just put him in prison forever and then they don't need to spend all that time.
So you could get a forever sentence.
Yeah, well, I think they're going to kill him, but they don't need to keep retrying and wasting people's time.
Yeah, there's no point.
So it was all centred around this murder of Bessie Mundy and it started on the Tuesday, 22nd of June, 1915. So the trial was really long. There were well over 100 witnesses. And George Smith regularly lost his temper. He shouted from the dark. He
called people names.
And then proving the cause of death was going to be essential, as the usual signs of drowning by being forced under were not evident on the bodies. They would have expected that if you're drowning someone, you usually, like I do every day, but you'd force the head under the water because that's the bit.
Yeah, head or shoulders. There'd be bruises.
So there was no bruising.
Because you fight,
hand over
you'd
mouth.
Fight.
Thing exactly. No, there were no signs of this. So he obviously hadn't done it in that way. So they
got him drunk first.
Well, they deduced that he must have approached while his wives were lying in the bath, grabbed their ankles or had his arms sort of like underneath their knees and pulled them upwards so that they slid down and their heads were underwater and sort of held them up by the legs. And then obviously once they're in there, your arms are down by your side, and at one of those old tin baths, you wouldn't have been able to sit up, you wouldn't have been able to get out.
Oh,
you're sort of just trapped
in there. Doesn't even bear thinking about, does it?
Well, you're lucky you weren't there at the time then, because to prove this theory, they felt like they won't understand if we just tell them about it. A demonstration was carried out in the court, and they had a nurse in her bathing costume to protect her modesty in a bath, actually full of water. Like, I don't know why they couldn't have just shown the motion. They had a woman in a bath.
Although, to make sure you get the sort of slippy slidey.
You want the slippy slidey, and basically people at the time were saying that you would have been able to struggle and that you wouldn't have actually died from it.
You could have put your arms up. Actually, I think seeing it would really help.
Well,
shall we do it?
I don't think we. They held this woman under the water until she actually passed out and had to be revived.
Fuck.
Using
you don't have to go that far. Like,
artificial
we get
respiration. Yeah, just get her head wet. It's fine. No, they dangled this nurse until
she
passed out. So then on the 23rd of June, the jury took 22 minutes to find him guilty of murder. And he was sentenced to death by hanging, which was carried out in the August, after which his naked body was just buried in a quicklime pit in the jail.
Unmarked grave.
And that's the fate of
him.
God,
he got away with it for a lot
really
of time.
Really fucking long time.
But I'm surprised, but I'm not, because who's going to dob him in?
Apparently, his hair was brown and his moustache was ginger. And I'm sure it was Roald Dahl or someone who says that you should never trust a man whose hair and beard are different colours.
Well, that is a rule to live by. But it shows that he must have had no friends, because if someone was confiding in you, it's a secret that you wouldn't keep, that one, isn't it? Like, you must have been a total loner.
Oh, yeah. He didn't really have any friends. He just had his
What's the point, then?
Women's.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Emma, for putting up with me having come straight from the gym without a shower.
Okay.
I'm finding the biggest myth of all time is that going vegan makes you lose weight, because I am eating every fucking thing, honestly. But it's because now I can rationalise everything.
Because it all seems healthy.
Yeah, well, also, like, if I went into a cafe before I was vegan, I'd just go in a cafe and not get cake, because I know that cake is naughty and I would regret it. But then if I go in a cafe and I see a vegan cake, I think, oh, they've made me a cake.
It's just for me.
I can't, Like, I can't turn down this cake. They worked so hard to make me a vegan cake.
You're still...
I've got to support this place.
The thing is, as well, you're still tasting all the vegan things.
Yeah.
Like, if you go to... You see a cake, like, oh, I know what that cake's going to taste like, and it's bad for me. If you see a vegan one, you're like, this might be the vegan cake to end all vegan cakes.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to try everything. That's the rule.
It's a very exciting time.
It's very exciting, but it's very bad for me. So now I have to go to the gym all of the time. I'm gonna eat some salad tonight.
But no one gives a fuck.
Thank you for listening. Again, it literally doesn't matter on this podcast. You have no idea what I fucking look like anyway. Thank you for listening. Donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/slaughterthepodcast. And rate us, review us, tell your friend about us, tweet us, email us, slaughterthepodcast@gmail.com. Yeah. Write a poem about us.
Yeah, draw a picture of what you think we look like.
Yeah. All of those things. And remember, listening to Slaughter doesn't make you a psycho.
I don't know why you always drop this on me.
You know it's coming.
Running into traffic does. That was an easy one. Running into traffic does.
Yep.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.